Welcome to A Cult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire at occultofpersonality.net. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and your co-host is Rudolf Berger. A Cult of Personality podcast is available on iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher Radio, Acast, TuneIn, and all the best podcast apps. This is episode number 180, featuring an interview with Craig Williams about his new book, Entering the Desert. The Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the Occult of Personality membership section, as well as our patrons who participate via the Occult of Personality Patreon campaign. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. Temple of Thelema is a true outer order of the greater mysteries, providing ceremonial initiation, structure training, and regular group work, all in conformity with the principles of the Book of the Law. An investment of time, effort, and commitment is expected from each member. Each is expected to aspire fervently to the great work, to dare with courage undaunted, to perfect that work, and ever to apply his or her best effort to effect harmony within the order and within the world in general. Founded in service to the AA, College of Thelema seeks to guide the student to an understanding of the Law of Thelema. Most especially, this means a deeper understanding of oneself and of one's true will. A combination of instruction techniques is employed, including seminars, written texts, and individual work. For over 40 years, College of Thelema has published journals in The Continuum and Black Pearl, as well as several books on occult subjects, maintaining high standards in Thelemic education. Visit Temple of Thelema at www.thelema.org. Now, in episode number 180, Craig Williams returns to the show to talk about his most recent book, Entering the Desert, Pilgrimage into the Hinterlands of the Soul, published by Anathema Publishing. Available via www.anathemapublishing.com. Practitioner of Ayurvedic medicine, Vedic sciences, Gnostic spirituality, and martial arts, Craig Williams is also the author of Cave of the Numinous, Tantric Physics, Volume 1, as well as numerous articles on health, martial arts, and authentic initiation in the Kali Yuga. Craig's most recent book is a brilliant and terrifying guide to the lonely, barren spaces of the soul, where we can descend within to realize the self. In the modern landscape of esoteric books, Williams' work stands out as defying classification, being grounded in practice, and engaging with reality on its terms. I highly recommend it. Craig Williams, I want to welcome you back to A Cult of Personality podcast. It's really excellent to speak with you again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Greg. It's always wonderful to be on your show.
You have been on the show many times before, to be honest with you. In fact, you may have been on the show more than any other guest at this point.
Yeah.
Which is good, because I have to say, I think the episodes you've been on, which a couple of which have been really excellent roundtable recordings, those episodes have been the, by far the most downloaded of all of them.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, that's, well, it's an honor to be a part. So you always have such interesting questions, so it provides us some really cool atmospheres to dive into for discussion.
Oh, thank you. I hope to keep up the trend here.
Definitely.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your new book. That's the reason, really, we're talking today. Your new book entitled Entering the Desert, which is incredible, but I'll let you describe it for the listeners.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, my new book, Entering the Desert, which is published by Anathema Publishing, was my vision of some type of pagan Gnostic worldview, which kind of came to me, ironically, on a trip in Tibet. Years and years ago, over 10 years ago, I had somewhat of a, I wouldn't say mystical, but just some kind of interesting Gnostic experience in the Himalayas, and I had this type of vision of a desert mystical tradition that seemed to be outside of my typical Vedic worldview. And so it always kind of kept it in my mind. It was something that I always thought about. And then I slowly kind of plotted it out over a couple of years, 5 years or so. And then it started to literally kind of come alive. And so I kind of wanted it to be almost a type of manifesto of how to live within modernity, but also have a radical world-affirming Gnostic view. And so that was something which I kind of wanted to do. I think a problem is that so many people have a radical disconnect between their spiritual life and their mundane life. And so it becomes really kind of totally surgically separated. And when that happens, we can have some significant problems psychologically, spiritually, even socially. So although the Enter the Desert text is a strange mystical text in some parts, it's also a very down-to-earth practical text in other parts as well, too, which I hopefully you could see by reading it. So that was kind of my vision, and that's why I even strove to keep Sanskrit out of the text. I wanted it to be something which, if someone had no interest in Vedic studies, Tantra, anything, they could come to it and still kind of take something from it back to their own system. Hopefully that makes some sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Craig, why do you find the desert ascetic such a compelling example for the solitary practitioner? What is it that this desert in the soul has called in you?
That's a good question. I think the symbolism of the desert is very evocative. And I think that the idea of the desert kind of revealed to me, it was almost a type of quantum image, because we can look at the desert as something ominous. We can look at the desert as something empty. Of course, if someone was looking at the desert from a modern perspective, it might even be a dangerous place. But we can also look at the desert as some type of peaceful escape, you know, something away from the madness of technology, something away from the madness of modern mass manipulation. And so it started to stimulate those ideas within me. And then, of course, we often think of kind of like some type of tribes or groups of individuals, monks even living in the desert in their privacy, working on their deep spiritual practice. So all those kind of ideas were cross-pollinating in my mind as I was writing. And I think, too, much like I couldn't help but wonder if, you know, even with the idea of Cave of the Numinous of my last book, this idea of the desert and then a cave, they're very powerful environments for us to have spiritual transformations within. And so that was something I think was interesting to me, and I wanted to kind of reveal that through a linguistic expression.
May I add something to that question? That's maybe very personal, but desert calls a type of image which might be different for each of us.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I hear desert, I see sand dunes. And I remember as a kid when I saw the Disney film about the desert, as a poor European kid, I was very disappointed that it happened in the Arizona desert, I think it was.
Right, right.
Do you have some stone desert, some ice desert, some sand desert? Do you have a special type of desert as a visual when you talk about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, I mean, I think it changes and morphs. I mean, I did spend a lot of time in the desert of, say, New Mexico in my life. But when I had the initial vision and the inspiration for the book, I was in Tibet, which was a barren desert type landscape. And so there was no sand anywhere, but there was nothing. It was just a whole amount of nothingness. So I think the idea of the desert being some type of malleable symbol that each person, it would evoke something different within each individual, became very kind of inspiring to me, both creative wise and also too, I think it really kind of moves the material into a deeper, which I refer to in the text, of almost primordial level. It kind of evokes something within us that resides in a soul level.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, because the imagery, but really, and also reading parts of the book, I feel like they bring out these feelings within me of, like you said, this stark isolation,
yes,
a darkness, and a real having to like come to grips with like all of these forces within myself and within Absolutely. The landscape, and there's nowhere to hide.
Exactly. Yeah, and to me, that's almost like the most powerful antithesis of modernity, right? In the modern world, we're constantly seeking to manipulate it. We can control the environment. We can control the lighting. We control so many things. And many people live in a completely artificial environment. They have completely artificial light, artificial sound, noise pollution. So the desert is completely opposite of that. You're taking away from all of that and kind of left just with yourself and the environment of starkness, and that can be frightening, inspiring, ominous, primordial. All these interesting images can really be evoked with that idea. So that's kind of what I felt in the vision I had in Tibet, in the deserts of Tibet, and I sought to kind of bring that out into an expression via a book, which wasn't just dry and empty text, but some type of kind of inspiring mystical text as well.
I like when you say the feral hunting ground of shadows and light.
Yes. That image. Wonderful. Yeah, it is. I think that's another kind of idea which I wanted to really bring up, is that this idea of the soul being this beautiful, happy place. Right. That's a very kind of an idea that's often pushed upon, that if someone has a mystical experience or a soul experience, that it should be peaceful, it should be balancing, it should be calm. But quite the opposite, actually, and even particularly in Eastern traditions and other traditions, the experience of the soul can be very scary, very dangerous. It can feel very ominous as well, too. And so that's something that the desert kind of symbolizes as well, too. And on the surface, the desert seems empty, but there's so much going on that we don't see. And at nighttime, it comes alive. And so that's much like the different phases of the soul we have as well, too. So all those things were kind of morphing in and out of each other. And I think that it also kind of signifies that we're directly connected to the environment that we're in, and that our spiritual life can only evolve in relation to the particular atmosphere or environment we have for it to grow within. And that's a frightening concept if we look at the modern world, right?
Absolutely.
That alone is an interesting idea that we have to look at if we want to see how systems are going to grow, how systems are going to evolve, and also what tradition with a capital T means in the modern world. It's very interesting to me, these ideas.
I agree. Would you give us some insight into the dangers of modernism as a worldview, and how this is especially dangerous for esoteric practitioners?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. That was something that was always on my mind as I was germinating the book, Entering the Desert. And I think that from a Western perspective, we see time as linear, and then we see time as this constant progression to something being better and better every year. It's kind of an underlying idea. But yet in reality, when this doesn't happen, it becomes very threatening to people, and they can't understand. We can see this now. People have no concept of the circularity of time, right? They have no idea of cycles coming and going. We think that anything that happens in our lifetime has never happened before, and we've never seen it before then, so that anything that comes up, people don't seem to be able to adjust to. So I think the modern world, we use that term modernity. What does that mean? And that's a great idea as well, too. And to me, it means a disconnect from the natural environment. I think on a fundamental level, the danger of modernity is starting to create artificial mind spaces, artificial environments of literal physicality. And then also those two things start to really, as what I touched upon previously, those things start to really influence the limitations of spirituality. You know, if you have an artificial worldview and an artificial psychology living in an artificial environment, what kind of spirituality is that going to produce? Right? It's just going to be, at best, an ego-produced spirituality, which on every level is going to fight to protect and establish the status quo. On the worst level, it becomes a type of secular humanism, which turns science and technology into the gods. That's something to me that's a very dangerous idea, which I see happening a lot. And it's always been a theme in my own spiritual practice, was to get reconnected to the natural world. And what does that really mean? I was very lucky to grow up in a time when I didn't have computers as a kid. We didn't have the internet. And so I think that that's a unique worldview. Some people don't know what it means to not have that technology. And so I think that the more we move away from any kind of connection to the natural world, we start to become what I typically refer to as the virus of modernity. And I think I mentioned that in Entering the Deserts. And to me, the virus of modernity is this kind of worship of a secular worldview where science becomes the god, technology becomes the god, and humanity becomes deconstructed to this almost samsaric garbage type factory, if you will.
There's the age difference between you and me. You said when you were a kid, you had no internet at home. Well, I had neither, but nobody had at that time. You see,
right, right. Yeah.
Modernity, you said, is linear as opposed to reality as we see it. And I couldn't agree more. Is circular, cyclic. And
right.
I think most of the esoteric practices, rituals, are also cyclic or circular. That's at least my point of view. I don't know if you agree, but is there a danger? Because when Greg said, why is it especially dangerous for esoteric practitioners, is that symbolism of the cycle the key to that, or am I on off track completely here?
No. I mean, I think that I would agree with you. I mean, at least with all the systems and the traditions which I've dedicated my life to, the idea of a cyclical expression of that is absolutely what we would come to see as the paradigm that we would want to operate within. I think that when we move out of that cyclical conception, that's when these ideas of modernity and esoteric practices becomes a slippery slope, and it becomes very confusing. For example, I mean, if you look across the modern spiritual landscape now, in particular, like, let's say, the occulture, the esoteric culture, there's a massive amount of people who are turning it into a business, right? We see people marketing online webinars to make money. They're turning magic and sorcery into some kind of like system of almost like life improvement, almost like a Tony Robbins, but some type of spiritual thing is grafted on top of that. And to me, that's just the ultimate example of the virus of modernity, of like this completely commercialization, commodification of anything that can get its hands on. And I mentioned that in the chapter of the wilderness and the entering the desert, where images become commodified, teachers become commodified. All these things happen in this way of how modernity starts to just deconstruct and desacralize spiritual practices. And I think that's why there's such a radical disconnect between people's lives and their spiritual practices. It's like they don't see everyday life as spiritual. It becomes so insular and related. And so then anything that happens in their personal life, they don't seem to be able to handle it. They don't seem to have a spiritual perspective for it. At least I see that in the majority of people that I'm encountering. That was one of the reasons why I kind of wanted to write Entering the Desert in anything. I'm not sure if you agree with me on that, but I see that as a massive problem.
Oh, yeah, no, I agree with you. Absolutely.
Yeah, I definitely do too. And this to me also echoes a lot of this ideas of spiritual materialism and the idea that you can use spirituality as some sort of self-improvement program, that you're going to transform into something greater than you already are, as opposed to, you know, kind of like giving yourself over to this process that's greater than you could ever imagine it to be.
Exactly. No, I think that's true. And I think that, that the idea of spiritual materialism is kind of thrown around a lot, but yet we see it happening constantly today, particularly within the current world. And so, you know, images are turned into what used to be like handmade art. Now, of course, is turned into digital images, which are used to sell things or which are used to be shared as memes. And everyone sits around and jokes and takes like special words from their tradition. And they're always joking within each other. For example, which is a concept which I touch upon in Entering the Desert, which is that how humor is used to commodify something, right? I mean, you would never see, for example, a Hindu, a Muslim joking about their tradition or taking buzzwords and making memes out of them or laughing at them. I don't think you'd see a Jesuit priest do that. But yet that's rampant in the modern occult scene. And if you challenge it, then you're looked at as, you know, you're the one who's called insane. So I think these ideas, that's another example of that virus of modernity just kind of like slowly seeping in and insidiously kind of infecting everything.
Yeah, certainly. When I hear you talk about the desert and what it calls in you, there are two terms which come to my mind, one being time, the other being patience.
Two relate. Yes, I think that's really interesting that you bring that up, because the idea of patience particularly is key, because that's one of the things which, you know, as I was writing Entering the Desert, thinking about that system, it's something that we are really lacking today, is this idea of patience and commitment to a spiritual practice. That was another kind of impetus behind Entering the Desert, was I would meet a large amount of people who were looking for some kind of spiritual practice, and they would, or even would even claim to be involved in a spiritual practice. But yet when you would ask them what they would do, there was nothing there. It might be buying books and collecting pictures, putting art up the wall, but when you really dug a little deeper, there was not what we would call from India a sadhana, you know, a spiritual practice. And so that was one of the ideas. I thought, well, there has to be something, some way to show that someone could have a pagan Gnostic spiritual practice without having to just kind of like what Greg and I have talked about extensively, without having just to take something from the East. Right, Greg? I mean, that's one of the ideas we see in the Western esoteric system, is so much of what they have is just something taken from other Eastern systems. So I thought there must be a way, there is a way that people kind of can kind of manufacture an infrastructure of practice, of daily practice, but that takes time and it takes dedication and it takes commitment and it takes patience. And those are things that for sure the modern world either claims to not have enough of or wants to speed up. You know, we want to speed up time because we don't have the time to sit down. We don't have the time to have a TV show longer than 15 minutes or 30 minutes, or we can't read books anymore. It has to be a short article and things like that. So I'm glad you picked up that idea about patience and time, because those are the two kind of key areas where a spiritual practice has to evolve within. And you can't really accelerate that. Any attempt to accelerate that becomes a very dangerous project. You know, even if there is an attempt to accelerate that, for example, within Tantra, people would say, well, you know, Tantra is an attempt to accelerate some kind of process. It is, but it's also inserted within a massive tradition of philosophy, metaphysics, ontology, medicine. And so all these things are there to prepare the person, which once again, it's an entire worldview. So you have to have that. So that desert worldview, it has a lot going on, as you can see when you kind of dive into the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Since we first met in 2012, we've spoken at length about this. You mentioned it just now, this gulf between established Eastern traditions versus more syncretic and many ways, I would say, incomplete traditions in the West. And I'm curious if you've seen any change since then, either positive or negative.
That's a really good question. I definitely don't see it getting better, sadly. I used to hope that people would maybe look back to different traditions and then start to maybe use that as some kind of a litmus test for how they would kind of help evolve their own systems in the future. But it seems to me that the modern vision wants to kind of leave everything old behind and move into some kind of new creation, which I think would be really exciting if we were seeing a bunch of exciting things being created. But I don't see that. I see a more and more kind of like a pick and choose systems happening. And then also, too, I see a lot of people starting to kind of function within some type of secular relativity where everything's equal, everything's the same. What does this really even mean to judge something in the first place? And so then we end up with this kind of vapid emptiness, and that also is reflected with a modern obsession with politics, right? I mean, we see that with people are becoming more and more obsessed with things that are less and less connected to their everyday lives, and then less and less having what I would call discussions about theology, right? I mean, if we look at any kind of system of like Gnosticism or occult practice, I would want to see like extensive philosophical discussion within those systems. We don't see that now. Now, any type of critical examination of any kind of occult practice is quickly discouraged. You know, anytime you ask any kind of critical questions about why some type of occult system is doing the way it is, you're instantly branded someone who's a critic, someone who is arrogant, someone who is too judgmental. In the past, I don't think we would have seen that. There was always kind of an interesting kind of discussion and even debate within groups. I mean, that's even – we look at Buddhist systems. When they present their systems to the Western world, what do they always show? They always show, for example, maybe a presentation of music, but they also show the debate between monks that appears as if it's an argument and they're going back and forth. And then at the end, it's resolved. That was a healthy debate. And today, it's like there's no room for that. You either have to believe everything that a system has, everyone has to get along, and everyone has to do that, and any question of that is anathema, to use another term. So I think that's something that's very sad to me. So as a result, we're not seeing a lot of critical thinking. We're not seeing a lot of, you know, of evolution of new ideas based on, sound ideas as well.
Now you see that in all fields, because also the way of stressing, oh, people are, you know, we have to take care of those people who are different. Yes, but each of us is different.
And yes.
Somehow that gets lost in that thought.
If I could just add, I mean, this is a really crucial point you're making. I mean, one of the ways it's described in the tradition is in the Kabbalah, they say that the iron is the symbol of wise men, right? And this is the whole idea that, you know, there's a clash, you know, and the victor in terms of view or philosophy or practice or whatever is victorious, is the winner and takes the field, right?
Yeah.
And even Pico, when he wrote about this, he said, perhaps that is why the Chaldeans, too, desire that at the birth of him who is to become a philosopher, Mars should behold Mercury with triangular aspect, as if to say that if you take away these encounters, these wars, then all philosophy will become drowsy and sleepy.
Wow, that's
exactly what you're talking about. That's exactly what you've described.
Literally, that is literally what I'm describing, and that's even why I wrote that chapter called "The Mirage in the Desert." I mean, there's many of these modern systems are just modern mirages, existing within a mirage, existing within another mirage. It's just like layer and layer and layer that becomes this solipsistic nightmare. Anytime anyone says, "Wait a minute, that doesn't make sense," then you're attacked as something who's threatening them. It's a fascinating idea.
And on the other hand, all of the ancient orders have a degree at some point where fight and almost war is part of the symbolism and part of the development.
That's very true. Yes, absolutely. And I think that we even see that now with this. I see a radical disconnect between people's bodies and their spiritual practice. Right, the idea that we must take care of our physical health in order to have a healthy mind, we don't see that pushed enough within the occult world and even in the philosophical worlds and most of the other systems, particularly in the East, there was no way to separate them, right? The physical body and the mental body were the expressions of the soul. And so I think that is something which we see disconnected now, too. People are kind of like struggling to understand their bodies. You know, gender becomes something which anyone can just make up what they want now. Philosophy becomes something they can make up what they want now. It's just like kind of like this relativity soup, which on a surface has this veneer of quantum marketing that, oh, it's quantum physics, anything can become anything, but yet they're ignoring the hard Newtonian reality of the world as well, too. And so that's another thing to me. The desert kind of makes you face the reality. If you're going into the desert, you have to have some things together. You have to have some ideas of what's going on. And so I think when people pursue a spiritual path, they need to be ready to answer these questions. And we should at least, at a minimum, discuss them, talk about them, dialogue about them without, you know, being attacked as dangerous. You know, I think spiritual practices also, too, should be dangerous. They have to be dangerous. If they're not dangerous, then they're not going to change anything.
You know? As in the Christian Bible, Jesus met the devil in the desert, didn't he?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so I think that's a big idea, is that there are these demonic aspects of the soul which we must experience, and that we must kind of look into that realm to truly become, you know, an integral being. I mean, these are ideas that, you know, even like, for example, Carl Jung touched upon, for without a doubt, that the modern world still, no much as they claim to love Jung, have completely ignored, to even to this day. So
I have a question that comes up as a result of your book and things we're talking about, because one of the ways that the Syriac Christian ascetics would deal with these type of things you're talking about, the isolation, confronting these demons internally, externally, what have you, is they had this angelikos bios, like they lived the life of the angel because that was the only defense against the world.
Yes, that's an interesting idea. And I think that's something that reminds me of the ancient magician stuck within his magical circle, calling up demons because he finally felt he was safe enough to do it within this kind of like safe space of his circle, right? Mm-hmm. That was the thing. So then the modern world, much the same way too, that these practices of kind of deep, whether it's spiritual or philosophical introspection, if you undertake that without any kind of topographic reference point, it becomes very dangerous. What you're speaking of, those kind of mystics, those kind of practitioners, were willing to go to that battlefield because they had a compass. Now, whether you want to call that a moral compass, that's an overused term today, or you want to call it a spiritual compass, there was some type of navigation point. I think this also, too, is reflected in another idea which we could touch upon, which is this idea of you see, with particularly in the occult world and the modern kind of like mass market now, they will say things like, well, perhaps meditation is dangerous. You know, we're seeing that trend now because sometimes people are turning to meditation and they're suffering from depression, and their meditation, quote, you know, makes their depression worse, or stirs up dark ideas. And that's such a great idea of what we're talking about, because, you know, these older systems, meditation was not supposed to make anyone happy. You know, it was not supposed to be something about making happy. It was about something digging in, you know. And I also think that's interesting, too, because we can sometimes say, and I do touch upon this in the book, you know, it's very common for people to quote Israel Regardi on this, and they'll say that, you know, before anyone goes into a spiritual practice, they should have examined themselves psychologically. And I think that's very important. I mean, I know a lot of people who are turning to occult practices who just need a good therapist, and they need it very bad. And so they're searching for something, and they're almost like their occult practice, their spiritual practice becomes a type of escapism. Now, having said that, if these people are having this dedicated spiritual practice, if these people are truly doing the work and their spiritual practice is completely unable to address any of their emotional problems, and they're having to resort to only some kind of secular psychologist, that bothers me just as much as meditation calling up demons, right? At that point, I'm wondering, are they really doing the practice? And then if so, is that practice even a viable practice? Or perhaps they should ask themselves, you know, this is a total crass analogy, but it would be if someone was studying a certain type of martial art and was really good in that martial art, but every time they got in a fight, they got beat up. And then they would start to say, well, maybe I just need to do another type of fighting to really in the street fight. But on the other side, I still am going to be a master of this art. That would be, there's kind of a disconnect there, right? You would have to say like, well, maybe it's just not working, you know, maybe, you know, is it not working because you are not a good student? Is it not working because your teacher lied to you and told you you were good when you weren't? Or is it not working because you learned on your own? There's so many, you know, there's not a direct answer to this, but I think these kind of discussions are important because we're kind of talking about central themes in modernity, which are kind of infecting ancient systems and occult systems as well, too. But I think that the idea of some type of compass that you have within that spiritual practice becomes something that no matter what appears in your life, whether it's a demonic being that you called up or did not call up, or whether it's just a life practice, or whether it's just a confrontation of your own mortality, there should be something there which is giving you some kind of guidance and kind of grounding you as well. And if your spiritual practice can't do that, I don't know what it's used for then, right? It becomes kind of a transcendent fantasy at that point.
These are important questions, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. So I'm glad you guys are asking.
For you, a different compass than the Vedic world. In the beginning, you said this was a new outside your Vedic world.
Yeah.
So is the desert a different compass of the type that you're just mentioning?
That's a really good question. I think to me, it's just a different expression of the demonic nature of the soul. When I say demonic, I mean this type of pagan expression of the soul, which exists outside of standard modern conceptions of right or wrong. Sure. Almost like that's kind of what I'm referring to. So when we look at Vedic systems, we talk about the cave of the heart, the cave, going within the cave, that's one thing. So I think it's always there, but to me the desert just became another metaphor for a journey into the soul. And also, more importantly, is how does one journey into the desert and then return back to the world, and both those realms still exist within a person? Because it is essentially what, for example, left-hand tantra would be about. Left-hand tantra would be about having some kind of intense spiritual practice, but also completely staying immersed within the mundane world, not seeking to escape it. So I think the desert is a type of journey into a region outside of civilization, but yet eventually we kind of return back, or we kind of get lost in another fantasy realm as well, too. So I think the Vedic system, which I practice, the tantric physics and the desert gnosis, they're very subtly interrelated. And if someone spent time with both, they would start to see the cross-pollination that goes on. However, I did feel that it was important to express the desert Gnostic ideas within a different linguistic structure, with an entirely different framework, because I do think, and Greg and I have had really fascinating discussions about this, that a lot of the Eastern concepts are just, it's very hard for Western minds to really grasp it. And to be able to grasp it takes a substantial amount of time and changing of one's perspective, which a lot of people either aren't willing to do or just seem unable to do. And I think that doesn't mean that someone is just lost then. That means there's a different way that soul atmosphere can be expressed. So I kind of sought to do that with the Entering the Desert text. And hopefully that kind of showed a little bit when someone reads it.
Yeah, I think it does.
You've spoken at length in previous interviews and recordings about the differences between ultimate union or moksha and kaivalya, or this cosmic isolation. And I'm wondering if you could just briefly review these and why it's important to be aware and consciously choose one, and how that's reflected in Entering the Desert.
That's a powerful question. Yeah, that idea of moksha versus kaivalya is something that I touched upon in the first tantric physics, and then also discuss it at length in the companion volume to tantric physics, which will be out in 2018. But I think this idea of this moksha is kind of complete dissolution of, you know, the drop falling back into the ocean. It's a complete losing of one's individuality, which to me it's kind of indicative of even the modern obsession, right? The modern world has these kind of ersatz or kind of fake marketing of you being an individual, but what it really ends up being is a bunch of people just blending into a sea of nothingness. Everyone just becomes the same. And so I think that moksha idea of everything just kind of blending into one is a fundamental idea on some level, but for a true spiritual transformation, this idea of Kaivalya, of something having this distillation of one's essence and retaining that sense of consciousness, is a completely important idea to consider and to explore. And that becomes something that for someone to do that, for someone to not just wish to disappear into nothingness, but actually kind of distill some part of their consciousness into this cosmic, when we say isolation, but it just means, I also think we could refer to it as a cosmic distillation. Because I think for many people, isolation is scary, right? You know, we think, but then we can also think, and I touched upon that in the chapter called The Cell. I mean, the idea is that we have to have some type of Gnostic isolation for us to grow. You know, we have to have some Gnostic isolation to kind of let our body heal, protect our mind, and also to be able to go deeper into our esoteric practices. But yet we have to be sure that that doesn't become an excuse for escapism, that doesn't become an excuse to avoid interacting with life and the different levels of reality that it shows us. So I think that we could say Kaivalya could be a type of cosmic distillation that to our dedicated spiritual practice, we're able to start literally create something which we have as a type of compass. So that literally, this is a very sobering idea, so that literally at the time of death, we are not afraid. That we literally have some type of cosmic kind of compass for us to use, as opposed to just this nothingness. And that's it's a heavy idea to think about. That was something that can only come through a lifetime of practice, and that becomes the reason why every day's waking up, every day going to bed, every day, whether it was prayer or meditation, was kind of gentle reminder that one day we were really going to need this when we least expected it. I think that idea is not even discussed at all in modern spirituality. I mean, rarely. You know, it's more about how can you help me make money? How can you help me be a better sorcerer? How can I have a cooler power over this demon or that demon? But nothing talks about, like, once I leave this temporary body, you know, what's my journey next? You know, am I preparing myself to handle the complete dissolution of my ego? Those to me are much more interesting ideas than whether or not I can, you know, call up a certain demon from some grimoire or something. So it's an interesting idea. And I don't see a problem with calling up demons from grimoires. I think that's great. But in my opinion, if someone is able to call a demon from a grimoire, their experience is going to be so radically changed that I would hope them, when they come back from that, that they're going to see the world in an entirely new light. And I'm not seeing that either. You know, that's the person that claims to be, you know, calling up the Lovecraftian demons, and then the next day is on Facebook crying about politics or something. You know, it's like there's such a disconnect. It becomes almost farcical at points. You know,
look, you convinced somebody with your book, and then that person comes to you and asks you, so he wants to be a potential student. How would you instruct that person to begin with, and how do you begin to identify and address the modernism in your own psyche? And is this possible without being in contact with a traditional lineage? Or, well,
yeah,
how would you guide that person?
That's a great question. I think that it would depend on the person and the culture that they come from. You know, I think I can answer that question in a couple ways. When I see most people come to me, like looking for a teacher, they're looking for a system, they're looking for guidance, etc., I often ask them, what's their background? What systems of philosophy they've studied? What systems of theology they studied? What type of personal practice they've had? And so those areas alone, I often find, are completely lacking. And so, like, oftentimes you'll ask people, they have studied little to no philosophy. They've had little to no personal spiritual practice. With that alone becomes problematic at that point. So I usually try to, you know, steer people toward at least a solid, basic philosophical grounding, and that they can start to ask themselves, you know, what are they seeking from spirituality? What are they hoping to accomplish with that? And I think particularly it becomes important in the occult kind of subculture, because the occult subculture is such a free-for-all of people and different systems promising just kind of everything from just hilarious ideas to very serious, sinister ideas. And so sometimes you have to kind of ask, what are you looking for? You know, what exactly are you seeking from this? I would hope that someone who would read Entering the Desert would be able to see that, oh, okay, I see that there is this need for a dedicated, concentrated daily spiritual practice and self-examination. But this also means that it's not going to lack any mystical experience. It's not going to lack any inspiring aspects. And also, too, it's not going to disconnect me from my everyday life. If anything, it should help me become more enthused about living this life, more enthused about living this world, and less affected by this world. And so those are some of the advice I would give people with that. I sometimes think it's ironic that people are searching for teachers today, because we have such mind-blowing access to people now, right? I mean, you can message anyone almost all the time now. You can contact people very easily. So I think that the contact to teachers now is larger than ever before, but I just don't know if people really know what they want. So I'll often encourage people to say, what exactly are you really looking for?
I think a lot of it is what you're touching on is like a fundamental, I don't want to say misunderstanding, because a lot of times it's more ignorance than anything. But, right. You know, people have an idea of this, what is often termed direct experience of the divine. You know, right. It's very ambiguous and kind of like you start to pick it apart a little bit and it's very nebulous. Like it's just experience on some level, but to actually understand the sort of mechanics of what gnosis means or a Gnostic experience entails, I think part of it is many people we're not even operating on the same definition.
I totally agree. I mean, that's something we can see. Like, you can sometimes talk to people and they claim to have been pursuing a certain type of spiritual practice for a large amount of time, whether it's, you know, 2, 3, 10 years or so, yet they've remained the same person the whole trajectory of that experience. That's not real then. Mm-hmm. You know, any kind of experience you have of that direct experience should transform and change you. And that we have to be prepared for that. And so that's something that I think people need to start to see if their spiritual practices aren't changing their perception of reality. And if actually the worst is happening, that if it's reinforcing their perception of reality to the point where if anyone comes along and questions them about it, they become defensive, or if they're unable to see how their tradition is starting to become diluted, then they just start to live in a mirage. And then that's where spiritual illusions become so dangerous, because nobody wants to question their spiritual illusions. Nobody wants to question anything anymore like that. So I think these are interesting ideas to discuss. Then there's not always necessarily a clear answer, but the actual dialogue and discussion should start to kind of put off some warning lights for people. You know, they should start to say, wow, that's a good point. Oh, I didn't think about that. You know, those kind of things should come up more, instead of just everyone should just be able to agree that they're right no matter what. I can't agree with that. Eastern systems wouldn't agree with that. And, you know, and so that's something that these kind of discussions should stimulate that at least.
But aren't we there in the same problem again, that those people would not confront themselves with, well, the darker side of their own being, and just stick with what they're used to, looking at the good side, because that's how they have to sell themselves in the profane world?
Well, you know, that actually is a really important idea, and we can even see this happening now in the occult world. We can literally see now modern movements toward making things that used to be considered dark in the occult world safe. Mm-hmm. There's two ways I would say that. To me, it's hilarious because it's just completely laughable, which is, for example, this is people trying to sanitize Crowley, or trying to turn, you know, something that used to be, you know, some kind of Lovecraftian dark, you know, gods are now really about love and peace and union. It's a complete kind of like rewriting of some kind of ideas to make it safer. We can see that happening. And part of that is just because they have to make it palatable to the modern because they're so obsessed with making it safe. They want to make it normal, which is funny, right? Because the occult's supposed to be dark, away from normal, something hidden. But yet this whole kind of commodification of occult systems, once they start to do that, they have to start sanitizing it. Because once it starts to come up, then these dark, troubling aspects start to scare people, you know? And so these dark, troubling aspects, even if someone has a dark, troubling aspect of their soul, it has to quickly be denied. It has to quickly be transformed into something else. And so we're seeing this happen now in the occult world, which to me is part of it's funny and part of it's just depressing because you can see they're just kind of starting to build another mirage to protect themselves from any kind of threat to their belief systems.
I'm wondering, you've kind of touched on this a little bit already, but what insight can you provide into the current political situation with regard to many in the esoteric community? Is it do the finger quotes? And do you find it interesting that so many who claim to be concerned with the eternal over the temporal or have special insight through spiritual contact seem to be so distraught or at least caught up at the moment?
Yeah, I find it absolutely hilarious. That's kind of what I touched upon earlier. I literally just find it. It's never-ending humor when someone who claims to have this great access to some kind of deep, dark occult power is, you know, on social media shilling for a certain candidate as if they believe that any candidate at this point in history is ever going to be not completely corrupted. You know, it's just laughable at that point. And then also, too, it's kind of reflective of the fact that you could almost say the more that someone is – you know, frightened, scared, can't handle any type of change. It's like it's almost a reflection of lack of their own inner stability of their spiritual practice. I mean, look at Tibet, for God's sake. You think they didn't have some political, quote, turmoil over their years of growth? And this whole system, which continuing to evolve within even that system. So I think there is two things with this. I think it shows that kind of obsession with politics and shows that radical disconnect I touched upon where their spiritual life and their mundane life are completely disconnected. They see no way those things can overlap. And so then anything that happens in the mundane world, it's just like a crisis for them. Mm-hmm. That's a big warning sign for that. Number two is that we don't necessarily have to say that just because someone has some kind of spiritual perception that they don't care about the modern world. We're not saying that either. Someone could definitely see something in the modern world and say, that's a problematic thing and I'm concerned about that. They can become involved if they wanted to become an activist of some sort. And that's their role as well too. But you would think that someone who's claiming to have deep spiritual perception wouldn't fall into partisan politics, wouldn't fall into fundamentalist ideas about certain things. For example, the most unbelievable thing we're seeing now in modernity is the glorification and almost worship of the CIA. We can see that, which is just absolutely mind-bogglingly funny because that is actually the ultimate mind game, mind kind of propaganda that the CIA would want to happen. It's like a Philip K. Dick novel. Now people are saying, oh, the CIA told us this. It must be true. You know, and this is an organization which, you know, basically, you know, functions to like kill dictators, you know, create entire fake scenarios to crumble belief systems, mind control. And so now people want to are kind of looking at it as some kind of like answer to their problems. It's kind of humorous, but it's also kind of scary. And I think that shows that people are really lost. They don't have a philosophy that grounds their worldview. They don't have a theology that grounds their worldview. If they do and they claim, it's not being shown. And so then they're kind of stuck into kind of falling into this, you know, political kind of virus that kind of infects every aspect of their world. And part of it's too, it shows how much people are completely immersed and addicted to what I refer to as the techno god or technology. They're constantly watching the news 24 hours a day. Their phones are constantly immersed in that. They're just kind of living in this constant world of media saturation, which at that point, we say that they're getting information that's being completely manipulated, that's being fed to them, that's owned by corporations, which wants a certain worldview to come through. And anything which doesn't fit that worldview is not going to get through. You know, it's just it becomes literally yet another layer of the mirage that they can't see, which is kind of strange because they're claiming to be such mystical masters of other things. So
it's because that creates for them an other layer of that safety or security.
Completely. Completely.
That's why they have all those phones and computers and everything, just not to have to think about any other situation.
Exactly.
You called that, if I remember well, in your earlier books, you called that alchemy of danger. And I loved that expression, because that's exactly what you're talking about and what is missing in such a situation.
Oh, completely. Yeah, I think that they're constantly kind of creating this kind of layer of security that the modern world can kind of give, but also, you know, all it takes is one flip of a switch and that's gone. Yeah, and then that, you know, that's also reflected too in this obsession with artificial intelligence, right? Now that's become like the new god. Like, if only we could be like a computer, then it would be magical, you know. And they try to refer to the brain as a computer, and although there are some mechanistic aspects of it, it's much more, we know consciousness is much more complex than that, right? And so, but I think that does make people feel safe, because then it becomes something they can easily kind of wrap their mind around, and it becomes just a constant security blanket. And anyone or any being which threatens that, you know, is completely seen as dangerous, you know.
What an easy way to manipulate them, by turning the switch off.
Oh, completely. Yeah, and then they become addicted to that. Everything has to support that. And that's even why I've been such a, you know, harsh critic of digital art, you know, because people, digital art just makes, it's like less and less a physical contact with the actual materials. To me, it's almost like, you know, digital warfare. It's like, you know, if we have wars and people are like literal brutally killing each other in front of themselves, that's a whole different ballgame between two guys sitting in a room pushing a button on a computer screen, blowing up whole villages, right? There's this kind of disconnect from the actual engagement in the creation of something or the destruction of something. And that's that more kind of layer of techno-god infection to me. So I think that we need to not become destroy all the computers. I'm not saying that. They can provide great convenience, but we also have to understand that they can also become very dangerous if that's the only world that we're living in, which literally becomes what, you know, a quote virtual reality of a fantasy land. And that's why I think a lot of people are attracted to many occult systems. It becomes like a virtual reality of fantasy land. They can kind of escape their lives and they never have to really answer to anything, because no one's going to ask them any critical questions about that once they kind of get into that realm. Challenging idea. These are kind of very important ideas for us to think about as we see traditions kind of continue to become destroyed and commodified, diluted. There has to be some people that called the watchers of these traditions that could at least kind of uphold some kind of perspective for people to understand what does exist on the other side.
Yeah, it really strikes me how much entering the desert, I mean, the act more so, but your book as well, is really an antidote to this whole situation. Not necessarily to simply go in and not come back, of course, but
right.
But to really come to grips with reality as much as we're able to anyway. And I know that that's difficult, because when I say that, a lot of people listening may be, you know, kind of superficially saying, well, you know, what does that really mean? Aren't we in reality already? And I would say, no, we're not. We're pretty much in a 99%, you know, mentally created matrix of
Absolutely.
Our own making, mostly. But, you know, a lot of it we're fed, if you buy into it, like you said, with, you know, fake news or worship of the CIA or what have you, then you're just making it easy for them.
It becomes incredibly easy to manipulate it. For example, if someone has a strong spiritual practice, a strong pursuit in any kind of occult practice, it should make them less easy to be manipulated. But the exact opposite is happening. And nowadays, it's almost the more people are involved in occult practice, the more easily I could manipulate them within 10 minutes with a textbook 1, 2, 3 of kind of mind control. It's very sad. It should be the exact opposite, right? You know, they should be able to see that their discrimination and their detachment is starting to become heightened. And they were able to detach from overwhelming experiences, discriminate what's important, what's not, and then act in the world, not become living in a fantasy land of some sort. So I hope that the text Entering the Desert provides some tools to enhance their discrimination, enhancing the ability to detach from manipulating influences and to cultivate some kind of inner experience, which becomes a type of balm for modernity, but also lets them understand that they could still function in the modern world without, you know, living some kind of dreaded secular existential empty existence.
Right.
which is very tantric, actually, but some people might not see that at first. But the idea of living a tantric existence is being able to see your life as a work of art that you're creating. An art should be very an individual expression, used by your own hands, crafted by the soil, and you, the flesh and blood, become the actual mediums through which you create your own, you know, expression.
Beautifully put.
It becomes a sacrament. You know, we want our life to become a sacrament, and hopefully the idea of the entering the desert. That's why I included some very interesting rituals as well, too, and a type of inspired text in there as well, too, which people could see that it's not just philosophy. It's kind of a radiating of some kind of sacramental presence in the body, too, that we can awaken, and that the natural world can awaken within us, too. And the more we're disconnected from that, the more robotic, the more empty society will become.
Hmm.
Soulless, literally, in my opinion.
You've mentioned something a couple of times now during our talk, which is coming back from the desert and the importance of that after having entered the desert. Could you expand a little bit on that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that is a very important idea to me, because I think it's important for us to not kind of look to spiritual practice as escapism. That's something. So we do want to enter into periods of the soul, periods of kind of intense Gnostic isolation. But we also, most of us, the majority of us, will return into a more mundane expression of our life. And we should return renewed, re-inspired, and also strengthened to be a better individual in our world, and not feel weakened, not feel more scared, not feel more confused. If that's going on, then at that point, kind of what I touched upon earlier, I'm not sure what the point of the spiritual practice actually is. So I think that both things happen, that some people are going to have to say, hey, I do need to take some time, disconnect from society, have some inner spiritual practices, but also know that I'm going to return and I'll be changed and able to kind of contribute something back to the world. I mean, that's an idea of social change, right? Even right there. I mean, radical social change could come through radical self-transformation. But the modern world thinks that radical social change has to come through laws. It has to come through government agencies making it happen. And those draconian laws can come, but we can see that that doesn't shift things. What shifts things fundamentally is a perceptual shift on a personal level that happens with large amounts of individuals, and then shifts can happen. So I think this idea of returning from the desert is also one of my visions of how this book or this idea can be some type of antidote to modernity, that we can actually have, you know, some type of social transformation, environmental transformation, if we have a spiritual transformation. For example, I think there's a direct correlation between spiritual emptiness and environmental destruction. And that's something which is a theme which kind of runs through, kind of a subtle theme which runs behind many of everything within the Entering the Desert text, is that if we ignore the natural environment, it's going to be kind of mirrored in the actual ignorance and the ignoring of our own spiritual practice and the reality of our soul. And I think we can see that happening now, you know, more and more each day.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the outer environment we create or destroy in this case really reflects the inner state.
It does. And, you know, we can even look at it at another kind of level and say that some kind of egoic realm, if the mass consciousness is kind of possessed and or manipulated on an egoic level, then destroying the environment would be in its best interest, right? Because it would want to continue to disconnect individuals from any kind of natural experience, because that was kind of giving them a taste of this kind of sacramental awakening of the soul. And so that's what, even why, you know, you could look almost, sounds rather conspiratorial, but that's rather an archonic idea of Gnosticism, I would say, as well, too. However, I don't think the prison is the body. I think the prison is the perception.
Touché.
You know, so I think the perception has to be, you know, the mirages have to be deconstructed so that the physical body can become the garden of the soul. And then to, for the physical body to be celebrated in that way, we have to acknowledge the garden of the natural environment. And for that to happen, we have to make some radical changes, and no laws can enforce that. that's only going to come through.
Sounds a bit like Pentilincola, doesn't it?
Oh, that's actually funny. Yeah, I guess you're right. I do. That's interesting. So that's, I think I would have to agree with that. I do. That's an interesting insight. It's a connection which many might be uncomfortable with, but I will comfortably tip my hat at that and say thank you. So. But I think these ideas are something that it stimulates a certain conversation, which takes us into areas of dialogue about problems with modernity, we can see that really aren't that disconnected from a spiritual practice. That's when we start to see that, you know, any kind of alchemical change in the physical body is going to be mirrored in some type of transformation in the world. And then any kind of a manipulation of the world is going to have some type of reverberation into our physical body and our spiritual realm. And to ignore that is foolish, and one does it at one's own peril. So,
yeah, well, that's the Hermetic principle, nothing else.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, it seems to be, you know, common sense, but yet we're seeing it being kind of ignored and pushed away for sure.
Yeah.
And then I think we have to acknowledge that there's always going to be an element of danger. The only way we can see some kind of change and some kind of transformation is if there is just the option for some kind of dangerous things to happen. And the more we seek to sanitize and stop that, the more it comes out in really chaotic ways. You know, it comes out yeah. in really strange ricochets of the psyche in many different ways. And so if we seek to continue to suppress that, it will find its way out, and it'll find its way in some kind of truly demonic expression, which is in many ways and often at that point, you know, completely uncontrollable.
Yeah. Yeah. Important things to discuss and consider, I think. I'm wondering if you would share an example of a practice that would allow someone to begin to create an atmosphere of isolation and intimacy with reality.
Yeah, I think on the most fundamental level that individuals need to start to have extensive periods of time in nature. I think people need to significantly start kind of reorienting their schedule so that whether it's, you know, once a month or two or three times a year, that you can literally have a place to go in nature away from artificial light, artificial sound, the influence of technology, and kind of re-immerse yourself into the elemental primordial world. And we can clearly see that mirrored in even medical research, where we see that, you know, levels of stress hormones, cortisol, will drop within 24 hours once people are camping. Circadian rhythms start to renormalize once people spend two or three days camping in natural light. And so I think that is a fundamental thing that people need to do. And I think that unless people at least start to do that, then it's to deconstruct the other modern mirages becomes a real challenge. Now, how easy it is for people to do that, I guess, depends on like where they live, right? But we can still start planning. I mean, I'm always shocked at how everyone seems to be able to get the newest iPhone update, but yet people can say they can't afford to go camping two or three times a year or something.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it's a challenge if someone maybe has a family and things like that, but then you kind of start to say, well, those are my challenges. And so that's my unique challenge, and I have to come up with a unique solution, you know? Every system that needs to be adaptable to the unique expression of the individual, and that individual also has to adapt a little bit to the system. There's a reciprocity there. And I think that's that kind of alchemical reciprocity, which we have to have back and forth. You know, if that happens, then we can see true change.
I completely agree. I would echo exactly what you're saying. Being in nature for extended amounts of time is healing. And I think it does open one up to a lot more of these spiritual impulses or mystical impulses. Mm-hmm. And there's also the element of danger there. And you may not perceive it, but I can tell you, having contracted Lyme disease last summer,
or maybe sooner,
that it's not a safe space. You can contract a deadly disease. You may not even know it when it happens.
Right. But
I still will go out there because it's worth it. It is worth it.
Yeah. because you can contract deadly disease and modernity and not know it for a long time as well, too. Good so, point. You know, it goes back. But that's a powerful example, Greg. That's so true. And it's very important for us to understand that and to and kind of embrace that as well, too. But I think that on a fundamental level, there's so many things we can go back and forth about what one should do. But I think that needs to be the first starting point, because then you have a chance of kind of clearing out your head of what's artificial, what's not. And if you can do that and couple that with a spiritual practice, even, of course, even better, you know.
Right.
And that's one of the dangers that lies within many of the spiritual practices, Western spiritual practices, which came into being in the 19th century in the Victorian era, etc. They were so high magic in the minds and the body and nature, and the other side, if you wish, has been pushed out of that spiritual experiences. And that's a danger to me for the very reasons that you just mentioned.
Oh, completely. I think that that is a wonderful point. I'm glad you brought that up. And that's where it becomes almost just like a mind virus, right? It becomes infected on a mental level and this imaginative level. And that's kind of something I touched upon in the book, too, was there's a very important difference between the imagination and the imaginal. The imagination becomes a fantasy land that people can manipulate things and they seek to escape from. While the imaginal is an actual mystical experience, which actually shifts our perception in ways that sometimes we can't go back from, right? And so that's something that the natural world does provide doorways into the imaginal realm that the standard imagination just can't, no matter how much, quote, virtual reality you're living within, you know. And I don't think I could have written or even been open to the insemination of the idea of entering the desert had I not spent a month in the mountains in Tibet. I don't think that would have come. So I think that that is a type of treasure or a tertön that I brought back from that journey or that trip. And that was a very challenging thing to kind of like, you know, eat and then have to somehow digest it and then construct it and put it back out. I was changed by that practice that, you know, so which is, that's the best thing we could hope for, but it's not easy. But I think that is very important. Those Victorian systems, those magical ideas, that, you know, that's when they started to become a type of escapism. You know, it became a total spiritual escapism as opposed to these kind of journey back into the primordial, you know, wilderness of the soul. So we have to return to that on some level. If there has to be some balance of that happening for some individuals, and hopefully some individuals will be called to that after reading the book as well.
Oh, I think so.
We were talking about practice just now. Mm-hmm. People who follow you on Facebook or who know you otherwise see that you as a person do a practice, a physical practice in martial arts, which is very extreme to us, somebody like
right.
me. But what is your personal daily practice, and what would you suggest to somebody, but like, well, say me, who is not so into physical training of every day, as a daily practice to enter the desert? The physical side, I mean, not the mental side, the physical side.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that, I mean, for me, the idea of practice of daily prayer, contemplation, and meditation become vital. And I think if we consider what we talk about, the idea of, you know, contemplation, contemplatio, meditation, and prayer, when I say those, I'm assuming that that means that someone's doing that in a space which is conducive for that to happen. And that also, once again, assumes that you've disconnected from artificial stimulation. You've disconnected from constant bombardment of your senses. So I think having kind of essentially distills down is moments of silence. So the people need to have little wombs or atmospheres of silence in their life more now. And I think that's something that they really need to understand. Now, within that silent space is what they do. It can be obviously depending on whatever respective spiritual tradition they have. But the actual atmosphere of silence allows that voice of the soul to start kind of calling out, and they can kind of retune themselves to it. If they can combine that with time in nature, walking in nature, hiking in nature, even better. And then the other thing would be that they would just would have to like a consistent, dedicated practice of that. Doing that once a week, although better than nothing, sometimes doesn't really do much, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like if you ate a really healthy meal once a week and every other day during the week you ate junk food. I mean, it's better than nothing, but you probably wouldn't see much difference in your health, right? You'd probably just, at that point, it would have to be more days of the healthy food than the bad food. So I think our spiritual practice is like that too. We have to be honest with ourselves and to say, how much time and how much space am I giving my spiritual life? How much room am I giving it to breathe? You know, how much room, how much space am I giving it to grow? So I think a lot of people's schedules are just so, you know, hurried and rushed that they end up kind of like squeezing out the time and space for any kind of spiritual practice. So I think that is another thing that people need to do as well, too. Just kind of take that inventory of time and see what's going on with that. My life, you know, my personal spiritual practice is deeply connected with Eastern Vedic systems. So lots of mantra, lots of studying of sacred literature, but also too, I'm heavily immersed in how the spiritual and the physical kind of blend and cross-pollinate back and forth. So I grew up immersed in martial arts, and Eastern systems obviously came from that, hence my interest in Chinese medicine and acupuncture and herbalism, and that's definitely tied into Tai Chi and Kung Fu. They're all interrelated. They weren't seen as something separate. Whether it was Qigong or yoga or meditation or breathing or pranayama, all those things for me were something which was just yet another kind of reflection of my spiritual practice. Not everyone sees it that way. They don't know me, so they're unable to see that. And then many people who are completely disconnected from their body, they see that they can even see what I do as a threat, right? They would see that as, quote, toxic masculinity. Something that any kind of male strength or power was something that, you know, was dangerous or something, which in other cultures, it was just normal, you know, so I think that we need to have some kind of physical vitality to stimulate us, because too many people today sit too much, you know? So I think if the physical body, the mental body is not kind of like vigorous and healthy, it's harder for us to do our spiritual practice. So I think that people need to say, you know, am I being active? Is my physical body healthy? Is my mental body being inspired? And then how much time do I have to even give to something spiritual? You know, I often think that one spiritual practice is an intimate relationship with our soul. And any kind of relationship, particularly a relationship which we would refer to as an intimate relationship, becomes very subtle, and it becomes something that you have to dedicate time to, or it becomes a fleeting experience that will leave. And so I think that we have to, at that point, say, you know, how much true time am I dedicating this for it to me to really expect anything from? You know, if you went to a teacher in India and said, I'm meditating every day for 30 minutes for the past year, and I still don't understand, they would say, then you need to meditate 2 hours a day for another year. You know what I mean? They would just say, you're just not doing it enough, you know, and then other people might be not doing it at all. We just have to be honest how much we're giving into something. Just like a relationship, we can't expect a friendship to grow if we don't commit some time to it. We can't expect any kind of relationship to really grow, the nuances to manifest or to mature, if we don't have some time there, and that relationship needs space too. You can't force that. So I think our relationship with our soul is like that, because the soul is always there. It's never affected. The soul, that's, you know, I take a very Eastern viewpoint. Our soul doesn't get sick. Our soul doesn't get damaged. Our psyche does. Our nervous system does. But the soul, it exists independently of those experiences, is constantly immersed. That's the idea that I talked about in Cave of the Numinous, the Achinta Beta Beta Vada, which is the inconceivable simultaneous unity and division, right? Mm-hmm. It's constantly both back and forth. So the soul is fine, but our psyche and our mind, our nervous system, need that connection to be truly inspired. And if it gets artificial stimuli all the time, it's disconnected from that soul, it can get very sick. So we have to examine that too. So I think it becomes like an honest evaluation of how much time we're putting into something. And then someone too needs to look and say, like, if I'm really not happy with where I am spiritually, perhaps I need to change something, you know? And then that, I think that's when people maybe need to seek another system, ask advice from friends, and start, just like you would look at something else, there might need to be an adaptation based on, you know, what's going on, some type of change, which can be scary, right? Change is scary, especially when it comes to spiritual practices, you know.
Definitely.
And I think it's fascinating to me, because if someone didn't know my background and then read Entering the Desert, I wonder if they would understand the other practices I do. I don't know. You know, whoever the readers will have to be the judge for that. If they do know my background and other writings and then go to the desert, I hope they find it just as inspiring too, because it's kind of like a journey into another realm. And hopefully they'll kind of sense that and feel that.
Oh, yeah. I think so. I've had and I appreciate it very much, the opportunity to look at and read some of the text, and it's truly remarkable, and I highly recommend it to people. I think anyone who's enjoyed this interview is going to get a tremendous amount out of the book. And this is, I think, also one of those texts that you could really base an entire life's practice around it.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because that was my goal with that as well, too. So I wanted something that if someone came to me and asked me, like, what should I do, that I could say, well, here, at least you have this for about 10 years worth of material.
Yeah, I mean, 10 years. I mean, people, they could literally work that for the rest of their life, I think. I mean, there's so much there.
That was my idea. And so that was something that, because I'm unable to help everyone, and I'm unable to guide everyone anyway. So, but I wanted to have some kind of text which was not just a dry academic overview, but some kind of actual, you know, linguistic and a sensorial immersion into something which could make and give them the tools to hopefully go on and work something else out on their own as well. So I'm really glad to hear you say that. That's the best I could hope for.
Yeah. Well, Craig Williams, thank you so much for joining us. It's always an honor and a privilege to speak with you.
Oh, it's been an honor. Thank you so much for the great questions, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
You too.
I'd like to make an announcement. The Occult of Personality membership section is being redesigned and resurrected as the Chamber of Reflection. Within the Chamber of Reflection, along with all the content from the Occult of Personality membership section, you'll also find a very fine members section interview with Craig about his new book, Entering the Desert, his perspectives, and much, much more. Additionally, there's an interview with artist Joseph Adams, who did the artwork featured in the Chamber of Reflection website at chamberofreflection.com. And I'd like to remind you that although you're able to listen to this podcast at no charge, the costs to produce it are significant. Your financial contributions ensure the continuity of the free podcast. Please support a Cult of Personality podcast by joining the membership section at chamberofreflection.com or via Patreon at patreon.com/occultofpersonality. And if you're already supporting the show or have done so in the past, my heartfelt thanks, and I salute you. Thanks for listening, and until next time. Thank you.